Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Now, as we opened the show last hour, we talked about our friend who's been on the show many times, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote a really interesting blog where he is senior editor at The Atlantic. And in that blog, he said, I'm going to throw this out before we introduce our guest, Bruce Dixon, to talk about what's going on in Georgia, to think about this throughout our entire conversation about prisons in America, in Maryland, and around the country, that African Americans make up 0.6% of the world population. That's men and women. But African American men make up 8% of the world's prison population. And even if we freed every black man from the prisons of the United States of America, we would still have the largest prison system in the country, incarcerating even more people than China, even if we left every black man and woman free from our prison system. What is going on? One of the things you don't know about what's going on is what's going on in Georgia right now that very few people in the national media have covered, where inmates across racial lines are on strike. We're going to find out about that. One of the places that you can read about it is the Black Agenda Report. Their managing editor is Bruce Dixon, and Bruce Dixon joins us right now. Welcome to the program, Bruce.
Thanks for inviting me.
So tell us what's going on in Georgia that we don't know about up here or anywhere else.
Well, today it's Monday evening in Georgia now, but since Thursday morning just passed, thousands of inmates in five separate Georgia penitentiaries refused to budge from their cells when those doors opened in the morning, refused to go to their work assignments or wherever else the prison might have wanted them to be. These prisoners were demanding more fair and just parole decisions. They were demanding more nutritious food and medical care. They were demanding educational opportunities in the prisons, and they're demanding an end to prison policies which make it difficult and hugely ridiculously expensive for their families to try to maintain contact with them in the prison. There's a national company that you guys probably know in Baltimore, too, called JPay. It used to be until a short time ago that if you had a loved one in Georgia prisons, you could send them a few dollars for toilet articles and commissary items through the mail by postal money order. You would send the person $20, $30, $40, $50, and they would get $20, $30, $40, $50. Now you have to go online, and many poor families are not online. You have to go online. You have to swipe a debit or credit card, and a company called JPay gets up to 10% of what you send your inmate loved one. To get a 15-minute phone call once a week will cost you about $60 or $65 a month. And there's another company that makes a big profit off of that called Global Tellink, which for all I know may be in business in Baltimore too. They're both national concerns.
I'm going to find out about that. I don't know the answers to those, but I do want to know. Yeah.
And so these are the kinds of things that inmates were demanding. They're demanding educational opportunities behind the walls. The Clinton administration, way back in the day, forbade the use of federal Pell Grants and other federal assistance for higher education behind the walls. And almost every state in the union quickly followed suit. And now the only educational program you can find beyond GED in the Georgia state prisons is a single program that produces Baptist ministers. So this is a problem. The inmates organized this themselves, and what they're asking for is nothing but simple human dignity. Now, in response to their nonviolent protest,
which is really important.
It's not only nonviolent. The other piece of it that's important is that these inmates are across racial lines. The black ones, some of them are Crips, some of them are Bloods, some of them are gangster disciples, some of them are Rastas, some of them are Muslims. But they've all come together on this, and they've united with the white prisoners in these institutions and the Mexican prisoners. This is amazing.
It is amazing.
In terms of the world behind bars, the world of prison is one in which the authorities hold absolute sway. And these are cynical authorities, immune from public scrutiny and immune from many things that we think of as principles and morals, because the prison authorities in America usually specialize in keeping racial antagonisms and alive and playing one racial group against another, playing one gang against another. But all of that has been thrown aside by the inmates who are standing up for their human dignity together in these four or five prisons in Georgia.
And what has been the response? Talk a bit about the response of the Georgia State Prison System to these nonviolent protests by Georgia inmates.
Well, the good news is that it's not Attica, not yet. There hasn't been a wholesale, you know, slaughter and taking back of the prisons, but the authority and for that we must give the authorities some small credit. But what the authorities have done is they have threatened inmates. They have sent tactical squads through parts of different prisons, rampaging through people's personal effects, roughing up prisoners, sending dogs in to bite them, and then denying medical care for the people who've been beaten and bitten. We've seen examples in a couple of the prisons where the prison authorities have shut off the hot water and shut off the heat. It's 31 degrees down here in broad daylight at high noon in Georgia this week, and colder than that at night. So shutting off the heat is a pretty inhumane thing to do. And of course, there's the live memory of our brother and comrade Jamil El Amin, the former Rat Brown, H-Rat Brown. Jamil El Amin was transferred out of the Georgia prison system into a federal supermax facility in Boulder, Colorado, where he's allowed one letter and one phone call per month and one visit every couple of months, if you can make it out there. And there's a fear, there's a very real and well-founded fear that the state of Georgia may retaliate against the people whom it supposes are the organizers of this by treating them in the same manner, by transferring them into the federal gulag, where they will be completely inaccessible to their communities and to their families. And so we're calling on the state of Georgia to resolve this respectfully, peacefully, and nonviolently, the same way that the inmates are posing these questions respectfully, peacefully, and nonviolently, to assist in the appointment of a fact-finding commission to investigate the truth behind what the prisoners are experiencing and to recommend some actions that will remedy it. We are also hoping that the U.S. Department of Justice will intervene, that the feds will intervene, and also contribute to this fact-finding process, and if necessary, be mediators between the state and the inmates and the communities which these inmates come from, because these are, after all, our sons, our brothers, our nephews, our cousins, our uncles. These are us. Almost every black family in America nowadays has an uncle, a cousin, a sibling, a dad, a son, a daughter in prison. And so this is all of us, and we've got to stand up for the human rights of prisoners. And these prisoners have begun to stand up for their own rights under terrible oppressive conditions. So how can we on the outside do less? How can we not stand with them?
Bruce, this is Anthony McCarthy. Two things. First of all, it is rare that we discuss something on this program on Mondays when I co-host with Mark, or my own program on Friday, that I haven't heard of before we even go into conversations about whether or not it should be a topic on the show. I knew nothing about this prisoner strike in Georgia until Mark Steiner informed me, told me what websites to go to. I'm trying to figure out who's watching this. Who is watching this other than your great report, the Black Agenda Report? But who in the mainstream press in Georgia has reported on this? And certainly I did a real quick search right before we went on the air of the mainstream press and the stories that were done on the strike. And I found maybe one or two. And then when you actually click on them and try to read them, they're like a paragraph long. So it doesn't go into issues. It doesn't talk about the fact that it's nonviolent. It doesn't talk about the racial implications of these groups who normally in prison would cut each other's throat in a heartbeat, actually working together to form demands, ask for civil treatment. This is fascinating, but it seems the mainstream press has shut it down.
And let me just say, as you answer this, Bruce, what Anthony was saying, I, as he was saying that, I looked up again, Georgia prison strike on Google. And the only places you see anything are some local papers, the Rome News, yeah, which is in Georgia, places like Hip Hop and Politics,
wow,
OpenLeft.com, CurrentWire.com, WorldwideHippies.com,
so the progressive
Georgia Green
press
Party
is trying
.com,
to get this out,
and your Black Agenda Report. But no one else is covering this incredible thing that's going on inside Georgia.
There actually is, Mark, a pretty good New York Times story, although all too brief. It actually is pretty good, and it does make the point that prisoners are organizing across lines that usually divide prisoners in America. And that's a New York Times article that came out on Sunday. Hmm. But you're absolutely right. There's been all too little coverage. We just came from a press conference on the Capitol steps, and there were a couple of local stations that that we talked to. We don't know if they're actually going to air the footage because that's the thing. You never know. And the Georgia Public Radio Network also interviewed us. But there is, like you said, there is much, much too little coverage of this. And we're hoping also there will be on Wednesday morning, and it's Monday evening now, on Wednesday morning, about 300 miles away in another part of Georgia, there will be a groundbreaking for a private prison. Corrections Corporation of America is building a new facility up between Savannah and Augusta, Georgia. And the governor will be there, and some of the top corrections brass will be there, and maybe some of the people who want, and definitely some people in that neighborhood of Georgia who object to the building of this private prison will certainly be there, and we may be making common cause with them, people who are who want the governor and the corrections brass and the federal government, the Department of Justice, to pay some attention to the plight of the prisoners it already has.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. I'm going to neglect you all to join this conversation. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page and give us your thoughts on this. This is unprecedented. One of the things the New York Times article said, and I'm sorry I neglected to talk about the New York Times article, that it said, was that this is also one of the first time that several prisons have coordinated their non-violent interracial strike against the prison system using cell phones, contraband cell phones, to let one another know what's going on, and saying they will not perform their chores, work for the corrections department's industrial arm, shop at the commissaries until the demands are addressed, including, as I said in the New York Times, compensation for their work, more educational opportunities, better food, and sentencing rule changes and better parole systems. I mean, this is unprecedented. This is something that, in some ways, if the government of President Barack Obama and others would kind of pay attention to this, to create and start having a conversation about what we need to do about our prison system, how we need to reform it, and how we need to address what really is the prison industrial complex that makes hundreds of millions, billions of dollars off of our prisons.
I think though that when you really people talk about a prison industrial complex, and it's a very real fact, and it's a very real concern, but I kind of think that the prisons are doing something that's not even making money. They're just warehousing what for all intents and purposes are people for whom the capitalist system has no use. I'm 60 years old. When I was 18 and 20 years old in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, there were still industries who were still locating near the ghetto black labor. That's a fact. Okay, that's the way it was 40 years ago. Now, of course, we're in a situation where the production and distribution of material goods that goes on in our country doesn't need most of us. They have outsourced jobs to China, to Mexico, to Haiti, to wherever they can get a lower wage, and prisons are now serving as a means to keep this surplus population in a state of subordination, whether they make money or not. So this is a question we urgently need to pay attention to, is the fate of our brothers, our sisters, our uncles, and our nephews and nieces in prison. And I'm sure it's something that goes to the heart of every black family in this country.
We have time for a bit more. 410-319-8888 before we move to what's going on in the Baltimore shutdown of our city jail and why it's going on. And I wonder in your reporting how you are involved in this protest at all, if you are.
Like I said, I'm 60 years old. I called up Elaine Brown, who used to be in charge of the Black Panther Party.
Yes, right.
After Huey Newton and David Hilliard. I was in the Black Panther Party in Chicago in 69 and 70. And so I called up Elaine just to check in about some stuff that was related and not related. And she informed me that this was happening. That's the only way that I got to find out about it.
I mean, if this was an Attica, if this was a Soledad prison, this was a time when inmates were standing up and like taking the guards prisoner or doing some violent actions inside of those jail walls, it'd be all over the press. I'd be covering it. But here you have an interracial coalition of a nonviolent protest, and no one's paying attention. And I think that's
something that we really have to reckon with. I mean, our folklore lionizes Mahatma Gandhi, who led a nonviolent movement for freedom in India. But you got to ask yourself, what would happen to Gandhi if the British had just locked him up and there had been no media to tell of his plight? What would have happened if Gandhi was doing this in a country in which he was in the minority? As a matter of fact, he had to leave South Africa and come to India for some
right.
of that stuff to work. You know, we've got a situation here where we think that the authorities in Georgia are grown people and not stupid. We think they're smart enough to resolve this peacefully. And that's what we're counting on. We're counting on them knowing the history of Attica and not wanting to make this another Attica. We don't need another Attica. We need people to be reasonable and respect each other's human rights. That's what we need. Prisoners are human beings. And they have a right to be fed decent food. They have a right to medical care. If you imagine that that the institution of prisons actually protects society, a supposition that I don't really share, then you would want prisoners to be prepared to be reintegrated into society. Our prisons, by not having educational programs, by not having recreational programs, by making it difficult or nearly impossible for families to maintain contact with their loved ones behind bars, frustrates the reintegration of people into society. In fact, our prison system, as constituted, is a major enforcer of intergenerational poverty. Once you are released from prison in Georgia, lots of places won't rent to you. Lots of places won't hire you. Okay, this is a situation. This is the situation around the country. Many families who have had loved ones in prison find out that they've got to take the prisoner back directly, because even if the prisoner goes out and gets a job, the prisoner can't rent an apartment because agencies won't rent to you.
Bruce, we have to take a break. We're gonna stay in touch with you over the next week and see what goes on here. We're talking about the nonviolent prison strike going on inside Georgia State prisons. It's been going on since Thursday. It's now Monday.
We're asking that people call the governor's office, the governor of Georgia, and also we'll have phone numbers of the institutions and some of the corrections brass and also to call Barbara Lee, the head of the Congressional Black Caucus. Mm.
Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today.
And we'll get you back on the air with us, and we'll put all those numbers on our website.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, Mark.
Good to have you here. Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the Black Agenda Report with Anthony McCarthy and Mark Steiner here. We're going to take a very brief break and come back. We're going to take a look homeward and find out what's going on in our Bartlesman City detention facilities. Up first in that conversation is Rick Benetti, who is the spokesperson for the communications director, of the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. 410-319-8888 is the number here. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And on our way to talk with Rick Minetti, I remind you that support for WEAA is provided by Chef Max and All That Blues, featuring live blues and buffet every Friday and Saturday night, and Chef Max Sunday Brunch with barbecue selections from the grill. Chef Max and All the Blues is located at 4907 Hartford Road. For more information or reservations, 410-319-6227. That's 410-319-6227. I do like barbecue. And we are joined now. We're going to look at what's we talked about Georgia. We're going to talk about what's going on in Maryland and Baltimore. The folks are calling in. Hold on. We're going to come to your calls at 410-319-8888. We want to start our conversation off with Rick Benetti, who's Communications Director of the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. We'll be joined by Tracy Velasquez from the Justice Policy Institute and Terry Hickey from Community Law and Action and Jacqueline Robarge from Power Inside. 410-319-8888. Rick Benetti, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Mark. Glad to be here.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. Anthony, I hope you're doing well.
Hi, Rick. Great to hear. Great to talk to you.
You too.
So, Rick, talk about what's going on. I guess the biggest question people have is whenever there's violence in a prison, there's always a shutdown. And there's always – then you have to go cell to cell, and you've got to find the contraband, find weapons, and keep the safety of the officers and the prisoners, the inmates, as the most important thing you have to do. But the question people have is why such a long shutdown, and why involving the women's side and the juvenile side when this all took place in the men's institution?
Well, Mark, you know, the mission of the department obviously is to protect the public, its employees, and the offenders, and we're responsible for keeping or supervising, and in that order. And no two lockdowns are the same. And you know, I just want to correct you. You know, not every violent instance inside a correctional facility ends up in a lockdown.
No, I misspoke. I mean, just, right.
I know. But you know, like the reporting of the Sun said on Saturday, that there had been several incidents that in the last week of November that led the facility administrators to lock down the institution in order to do an entire shakedown of the facility looking for contraband. What fuels most violence in prison or correctional situations? This is a jail, remember. A detention center, not a prison, is contraband and sort of the illegal activities that surround contraband.
So, Rick, this is Anthony. I'm curious because Mark and I have been inundated with emails and calls from family members who wanted to draw our attention to this, but they're saying they weren't informed until they either arrived at the prison or they started to get news accounts that they would have no access to their loved one who is in this correctional facility.
Yeah, the facility administrators decided to go with the lockdown after consulting with our lawyers in the Attorney General's office, and actually we're in communication with a lot of the folks involved with the Duval case,
mm-hmm.
And also the DOJ, the on the federal side, and did get word out to many of our community partners that this was the situation, and it would be ongoing for at least a little while. And, you know, I don't know, I can't speak to sort of any specific instances with mm-hmm. family members that didn't get communicated with effectively. But, you know, there are upwards of 2,600 individuals detained in that facility. And as you can imagine, that's a pretty large undertaking.
I guess the question that the press has been asking and a lot of people have been wondering and from the outside, especially those doing services on the inside, is the length of this. It seems the undetermined time this will take place, that there have been other lockdowns going through the entire prison. They've lasted a few days. The people who were inside who created these actions were sent to solitary. They were moved to another prison. The contraband was seized, and then the prisons opened back up to visitors into the programs, especially now in holiday season, with especially the women's prison, with women and their children spending some time in the holiday together while they're waiting trial. So, I mean, nobody can quite understand on the outside of your walls why it is an indeterminate amount of time that you are locked down.
Well, you know, again, I'll just say no two lockdowns are the same. And in this particular instance, this is the course that the facility administrators thought was needed to protect the employees and also the detainees there awaiting trial. I will say, though, you know, I was talking to some of the administration people down there today, and it's likely that this lockdown will be ended before the holidays get here. And as a matter of fact, there's already some, we know they've, in some housing units have already shifted to a sort of controlled movement type situation. But, you know, and obviously everybody's sympathetic to the holiday season and how important it is for folks to be in touch with their families. So, you know, everybody there is working as hard as they can to get this situation.
And again, one last thing before I know you have to run, and we're going to go to our other guests who are waiting to come online to talk about this as well. Is the kind of clear understanding about why the children's side, the juvenile side, and the women's side is shut down as well?
Well, it's all part of the facility, and you know, I'm not going to talk about the security practices going on there and what. A lockdown entails, except to say that, you know, the people that are there and in that environment are professionals, and if they deem it necessary to lock down the facility, then they will.
Rick Bennett,
let me clarify.
Go
as well. If you got a couple of seconds here.
Sure.
You know, when it comes to the youth, for sure, all of their programming is still happening in terms of mental health counseling, in terms of any drug treatment, in terms of their school, and the entire facility. The detainees are all making their court appearances, they're all making their lawyers with their meetings, and they're all, you know, whatever health needs they have are being met. that hasn't changed. And, you know, your listeners should also understand that more than half of the population in that institution is in the dormitory environment. So, you know, they are up, about, and moving around in the dorms all day long. And like I said, there's already some controlled movement in some of the other units there.
Rick Benetti, I appreciate you taking the time and joining us, and we look forward to talking to you again very soon.
No problem, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us.
Happy holidays, guys.
You
Take
too.
Care, Rick.
Bye-bye.
Rick Benetti, Communications Director for the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. Number is 410-319-8888. We are now joined on the phone by Jacqueline Rabarge, who is Executive Director of Power Inside, that works inside the Women's Institution. We are joined by Terry Hickey, who is Founder and Executive Director of Community Law in Action. And Tracy's with us yet, Tracy Velasquez. Velasquez, who should be with us in a few minutes, who is Executive Director of the Justice Policy Institute, will also open the phones here in just a second. Folks, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Thanks, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, Jackie. So, Jackie, what do you all know about what's going on so far from your perspective? I mean, it's try to get a sense from Rick Minetti what was going on in terms of why this lengthy shutdown. It sounds like some of the political moves, at least from y'all and others on the outside, are kind of pushing the government to rethink its decision, open this thing up before the holidays. And Jackie Velasquez is now with us as well, executive director of the Justice Policy. Tracy, mm-hmm. Justice Policy Institute. Tracy, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
So, do you think that's taking place?
We'll start with Jackie.
Jackie, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I'm just joining the call.
Oh,
Jackie Robarge?
Yes. It's Jacqueline Robarge. They just connected me. So
I'm sorry. I thought you were
on the line. I'm sorry.
The question was, it sounds like some of the press and coverage and the political pressure from the outside is actually pushing this thing to end earlier than we thought. Jackie?
Well, I can't speak to that. I do know that our program is eager to serve the women in the detention center, and the Department of Public Safety has always been our partner for the past 10 years in serving homeless and drug-addicted women, and I don't expect that to change, but we are eager to reach the homeless women who are soon to be released there.
Well, just for clarification for our listeners, Jackie, are you providing services now, or during the lockdown, are you not providing services?
We are not providing services during the lockdown.
We just need you to be as specific as possible and not speak in generalities.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I just needed her. She was saying that they're eager to provide services.
But they're not providing them.
They're not providing them right now.
So,
yeah.
Tracy, let me ask you. Welcome. It's good to have you with us. So do you think this political pressure is changing the nature of the policy right now?
Well, I hope so. You know, obviously there was a lot of concern among service providers and family members and the clergy that they weren't going to be able to get to see folks who are in the Baltimore jail. And you know, as I think you mentioned earlier, not a lot of folks understood what was going on or the potential length of this. So to the extent that folks are speaking up and saying, look, you know, it's not just, you know, this is not just a luxury. It's really important to maintain relationships with people when they're incarcerated. To the extent that that's happening, I think that that's great.
Let me open the – Tara, do you want to jump in on this before we open the phones here?
Sure. Well, I just wanted to throw in that I'm glad Rick said that some essential services were being recontinued, because I do know that a lot of the enhanced services, some of the – after-school style programming, some of the organizations that are working with young people to help them through their trials and some of these experiences have not been allowed back in. So I'm hoping that's going to end soon based on what Rick said.
Let's open the phones here and let folks join us as we were looking at prisons around the country. Let me just throw this stat out because our guest here didn't hear it before, and I'm just so overwhelmed by it that I want to share with our listeners again, as we also talked about what's going on in the Georgia State prisons that very few people in the country are covering, which is a nonviolent strike among inmates across racial lines, white, Latino, black, crossing gangs and religious lines, nonviolent strike for better working conditions, better living conditions, the right to better parole.
Educational programs
mm-hmm. are taking on in Georgia State Prison that no one is covering at the moment. And one of the things that Ta-Nehisi Coates said in his latest blog at Atlantic is that, and this is a pretty shocking, just let it sink in for a moment, when we talk about Baltimore City or any other place, that 0.6% of the world's population are African-American men and women, 0.6% of the world's population. 8% of the world's prison population are African-American men. And that even if you took and freed every African-American person from the prison systems of the United States of America, the United States of America would still have the largest prison population of any nation on the planet Earth. 410-319-8888 is the number here. A caller called in to say that Attica got a bad rap in the last segment, that it was actually about food and rights, and we should not diminish that. We weren't diminishing that. We were just saying that what's amazing here is this was it's a non-violent cross-racial protest by prisoners in the Georgia State prison system, and no one in America is paying attention to it. That's what. And if they were killing each other,
that's right. If it was violent,
we'd be paying attention to it.
Yeah.
But we're not paying attention to this nonviolent protest. Let's go to the phones of 410-319-8888. Perhaps you have loved ones that are in the detention center. You want to hear what's going on. We have our three guests here to answer as much as they can. And Francisco, you're on the air.
Hi. So I have a general question for the group.
Sure.
And you brought a little bit to to my question. We have a huge population of people in prison. When we look at women and children, women in prisons and children incarcerated, it is almost exclusively drug-related now. I mean, the percentage of violent criminals has been, as a population of our prison systems, is dropping. And I think that the whole concept of actually providing a just system is flawed from the beginning as to where the criminals are coming from, how they're getting unfair treatment in the court systems across the board. So when you look at locking down these groups, I'm surprised anybody cares, since this whole population is kind of the underclass of America. We're creating this black Hispanic underclass. And as far as the prisons go and contraband, what percentage of the contraband in prisons are actually being smuggled in with the help of the administration, the guards, the staff, et cetera? So are they locking down the entry point if they're involved, if the staff and the guards are involved?
Well, I won't make Terry or Jackie feel uncomfortable with that question, but I will let Tracy answer it.
Hey, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, I could tell you, you know, now first I just wanted to remind folks that the Baltimore jail is people who are there before their trial. They have not, 9 out of 10 of them have not been guilty of the offense for which they're being jailed. So it's a little different than a prison where people are serving a sentence. So, but I would say when we looked at, when we did a study, we called it Baltimore Behind Bars, about the Baltimore jail, about between one in four and one in three folks who are in the jail were there for a drug conviction, or not, excuse me, a drug arrest, not a conviction. And so, you know, in terms of the lockdown, there are a lot of folks who have substance abuse issues, mental health issues, you know, other sorts of issues there. You know, there are some folks who are there for violent arrests, that's true, but it really crosses a broad spectrum. And I think that's why people care. You know, it's a local jail with local people who are there. And so if you think about every person who's in jail, if they have a circle of 10 people around them, family, friends, who care about them, or you're talking about a pretty large percentage of the folks in Baltimore.
And, Mark, what Tracy is talking about is really
important.
In terms of the drug addiction, you know, we had surveyed both the men and the women, and if you look at just the prevalence of their substance use, we have about 55 to 59% of the women saying they use drugs daily prior to entry into the jail, and about 78% of the men. And because it is a pretrial facility, they're cycling through very quickly with very short lengths of stay on a much higher volume than prisons. And so I think, you know, the focus on pretrial is really important to Baltimore City, because we're talking 73,000 people, according to Justice Policy Institute's report, and 35,000 people into the detention center. And so that's a huge number of people, most of whom are coming out with a vast amount of needs. I mean, half the women we serve are homeless coming out of jail, and about 37% of the men have unstable housing, and it's just a tremendous need. And, you know, each day that goes by, more and more folks are coming out that, you know, need housing, drug treatment, health care, et cetera.
Terry, this is Anthony McCarthy. I'm very curious. We talked to Rick earlier. He mentioned, Mark asked very pointedly about the children's, the juvenile and the women's facilities being shut down. I don't think we really ever got an answer to that. But I'm very curious if you could characterize for us. This is pretrial. And it's gone on for some time. We were told by The Sun that they expected it to be shut down past Christmas, but now we're hearing from Rick that that looks like that's not going to happen. But I think people are curious about how these trials for these young people are going to be affected if you all don't have access to them.
Sure. Well, and I think one thing that's important, and I want to thank you guys for talking about this issue in the juvenile unit so often on the show. For the folks that haven't actually caught one of those shows, there is a juvenile unit for young people age 14 to 17 that have been charged but not convicted of serious offenses. And what's a little unusual for the juveniles there is that a recent study that we had worked on showed that a significant amount of those young people end up back in the juvenile system eventually, but they spend significant time at the Baltimore City Detention Center awaiting trial or awaiting some kind of a hearing to put them back in the juvenile system. So you've got young people kind of all over the spectrum. On one end, you've got young people that may end up in the prison system. And remember that while groups are shut out, if a young person turns 18, they're put into the adult population, which means that immediately, sort of, you know, good morning, it's your birthday, we're going to move you. And there's a reality to that, but you can lose a young person you've been working with if they turn 18 during the lockdown. The other reality is that, you know, these are still juveniles. And even though they're considered as adults by the law, there is a school that does a great job within the facility, and it's good to hear that that's still operating. We weren't sure that was the case during the lockdown. But what I was told today was that IEPs, these individual education plans that youth have, which link them with mm-hmm. services for learning disabilities and whatnot, there's actually a caveat in the law that says those can be suspended or changed if it's designated to be a public safety concern.
Hmm.
And so what folks need to understand, and I don't want to beat the proverbial dead horse, but
no, go ahead.
Young people that are in there, they're in an adult facility. And first and foremost, I think the folks that run pretrial do a good job. They're concerned about these young people. I've talked to them about this. They actually want to make sure we know how concerned they are. But at the end of the day, it's an adult facility. And the lockout proves not that they have an intent to do ill by these children, but that they can isolate the children from services.
And I'm sorry we have to jump out of here, sure. But we're going to come back to this and follow this. And I want to thank all of you, Terry Hickey, Jacqueline Robarge, Terry Hickey, who's Executive Director of Community Law and Action, Jackie Robarge, who's Executive Director of Power Inside, Tracy Velasquez, Executive Director of the Justice Policy Institute, A, for the work you do, and B, for joining us tonight.
Great.
Thanks
again.
Great. Thanks.
And we'll stay on top of this as well. And Anthony McCarthy,
very important issue.
Thank you,
very
brother,
important.
For always being
always
with me on Mondays.
Always great to be with you, Mark.
And, folks, we're going to take a very break right now. We have to go to Bernie Sanders and hear him talk to Congress and the Senate.
I think everyone knows the President of the United States, President Obama, and the Republican leadership have reached an agreement on a very significant tax bill. In my view, the agreement that they reached is a bad deal for the American people. I think we can do better. And I am here today to take a strong stand against this bill. And I intend to tell my colleagues and the nation exactly why I am in opposition to this bill. And you can call what I'm doing today whatever you want. You can call it a filibuster. You can call it a very long speech. I'm not here to set any great records or to make a spectacle. I am simply here today to take as long as I can to explain to the American people the fact that we have got to do a lot better than this agreement provides. There is no doubt in my mind what many of my Republican colleagues want to do. And that is, they want to move this country back into the 1920s, when essentially we had an economic and political system which was controlled by big money interests, where working people in the middle class had no programs to sustain them when things got bad, when they got old, when they got sick, when labor unions were very hard to come by because of anti-worker legislation. And that's what they want. They don't believe in things like the Environmental Protection Agency. They don't believe in things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, federal aid to education. And that is the fight that we will be waging. And I think to surrender on this issue is simply to say that we're going to be waging fight after fight starting within a couple of months. Now, Mr. President, President Obama has said that he fought as hard as he could against the Republican tax breaks for the wealthy and for an extension in unemployment. Well, maybe, but the reality is that that fight cannot simply be waged inside the Beltway. What our job is to appeal to the vast majority of the American people to stand up and to say, wait a minute, I don't want to see our national debt explode. I don't want to see my kids and grandchildren paying higher taxes in order to give tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires. The vast majority of the American people do not support that agreement in terms of giving tax breaks to the very rich. And our job is to rally those people. And I would like very much to see the American people saying to our Republican colleagues, some Democratic colleagues, excuse me, don't force my kids to have a lower standard of living in order to give tax breaks to the richest people in this country. And what the president and all of us should be doing is going out and saying to those people, call up the members of the Senate, call up the members of the House and say, excuse me, how about representing the middle class and working families for a change rather than the wealthiest people in this country? It is important to put the agreement that the president struck with the Republicans in a broader context. You can't just look at an agreement unto itself. You have to look at it within the context of what's going on in this country today, both economically and politically. And in my view, and I think I speak for millions and millions of Americans on this, there is a war going on in this country. And I'm not referring to the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan. I'm talking about a war being waged by some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in this country against the working families of the United States, against the disappearing and shrinking middle class of our country. The billionaires of America are on the warpath. They want more and more and more. And that has everything to do with this agreement reached between the Republicans and the president. Mr. President, in 2007, the top 1% of all income earners in the United States made 23.5% of all income. Let me repeat that. Top 1% earned over 23% of all income. That is more than the bottom 50%. 1% here, 50% here. But for the very, very wealthy in this country, that's apparently not enough. The percentage of income going to the top 1% nearly tripled since the 1970s. Now, all over this country, people are angry, they're frustrated. It's true in Vermont, I'm sure it's true in Virginia, it's true all over America. But one of the reasons that people are angry and frustrated is they're working incredibly hard. In the state of Vermont, which I represent, I can tell you, there are people who don't work one job, they don't work two jobs. There are people who are working three jobs and four jobs trying to cobble together an income in order to support their families. And I suspect that goes on all across the country. But people are working harder and harder. In many cases, their income is going down. And the fact is that 80% of all new income earned from 1980 to 2005 has gone to the top 1%. But that is not apparently enough. Our friends at the top, who have a religious ferocity in terms of greed, they need more and they need more. It's like an addiction. 50 million is not enough. They need 100 million. 100 million is not enough. They need a billion. Billion is not enough. I'm not quite sure how much they need. When will it stop? Today, in terms of wealth as opposed to income, the top 1% now owns more wealth than the bottom 90%. You know, Mr. President, we went to school and we used to read in the textbooks about Latin America, for example, and they used to refer to some of the countries there as what they call banana republics, countries in which a handful of families control the economic and political life of the nation. Well, I don't want to get the American people too upset, but we are not all that far away from that reality today. Top 1% has seen a tripling of the percentage of income they earn since 1970s. Top 1% owning 23% of all income, more than the bottom 50%. Top 1% now owns more wealth than the bottom 90%. That's not the foundation of a democratic society. That's the foundation for an oligarchic society.
That was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent, who's one of the few people in the entire United States Congress to really stand up and talk about the interests of working people and middle-class people in our country. We'll talk more about that during the coming week. Thanks for listening. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.